Hello, sex fans, and welcome back. Today is Monday, November 16th, 2009, and you are lucky enough to be listening to the podcast edition of Dr. Dick's Sex Advice with an Edge.
Who are you?
Why, I'm your host, little fella, that savagely scintillating sexologist, Dr. Dick. We're back with more of the Erotic Mind podcast series today. Over the last year and a half, we've spent numerous hours with talented authors who have talked with us about their creations, erotic short stories, and novels. Today, we diverge a bit from our standard fare to broaden that perspective to include yet another type of sex writing, the memoir.
You're disgusting.
You know what? You need to lighten up, girlfriend. I am honored to welcome one of the shining lights of this genre, an enormously talented essayist, poet, teacher, and comedic genius, Kevin Keck. And he is the author of three critically acclaimed memoirs, each brilliantly funny and smutty as all get out. He's been knocking audiences dead with readings from his work in personal appearances and on the radio. And I am happy to report that he will treat us in the same vile manner. Kevin will read two hilarious selections from the fruit of his erotic mind. You'll be laughing out loud as he reveals strange and embarrassing details about his sex life.
Oh yeah, who you talking dirty to?
It's not me, it's Kevin, honest. And for more of Kevin, his writing, interviews, and readings from his memoirs, be sure to visit him on his website, thekeck.com. Or his Facebook page, facebook.com/writerkeck. Today's program is once again brought to you by Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. You know, even though I get tons of email from folks looking for my advice, I can only respond to a limited number of inquiries at any given time. But that doesn't mean that I don't care about everyone who writes in. I do. That's why I've set up my How-To Video Library. You'll find a link to this great resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the Video On Demand tab.
I don't know how to work it, so I was kicking it and swearing at it, you know, which is not an uncommon thing to do.
That's why I present the Video Library. It's the go-to place for all of you who have sexual performance questions. You'll be able to watch all kinds of deliciously entertaining, delightfully enriching, and oh-so-informative videos right from the comfort of your own home. How sweet is that? Okay, on with the show. Welcome, Kevin, and thank you for joining us here at DrDickSexAdvice.com. I'm so delighted that we finally get to do this Erotic Mind podcast together. It's been such a long time in coming, but I'm glad we persevered. Would you like to say hello to the nice people?
Hello, nice people.
And I'm afraid I must also tell you that there are likely to be a load of perverts skulking around listening in, so you'll probably want to say hello to them, too.
Hello, perverts. I thank you for paying my rent.
Oh, for sure. Listen, I'm afraid I must tell you that I've been spending lots of time on your website, thekeck.com. You are an accomplished fellow and a comedic genius to boot. How do you stand yourself?
Well, you know, curiously enough, my wife told me just this week that I was a total asshole for the first couple of years we're married, and I've been reflecting on it, and I've realized I have been an asshole, so I don't know how I've been able to stand myself if the people who love me feel that way.
Right, and she's being so kind to tell you.
Well, I appreciated it. I'm always big on self-reflection.
Right. And that comes clear in your work, and we'll get to that in a minute. But I wanted to say that apparently you're not just a pretty face. You're the author of three exceptionally well-received books. You write for several magazines, including one of my favorites, Details. You're a husband and a father of three, mind you, and an agnostic North Carolinian. Have I left anything out?
I am also a breeder of cats, although they sort of take care of that themselves. No, I do have a lot of cats, though. You know, country cats, farm cats.
Right.
Yeah, so they gather around and bring me about two or three mice a day. And
because you can't have too many of those. So when do you find time to touch yourself in purely with all these things going on?
Not as much as I'd like to, and not as much as I used to, if at all. These days, what energy I have, I feel, you know, it's best invested with my wife as opposed to myself. But
well, that's good.
That makes you less of an asshole,
probably.
And it keeps things running smoothly around the house.
Uh-huh.
Though after she hears this and hears my admission of that, I'm probably going to be...
cut off.
Yeah. Well, no, she doesn't work like that. She will actually make me do it three or four times as much, which is, you know, she's 37. Oh, wait, she's 27. I'm sorry.
Let's not tell her that this is going to premiere on the site anytime soon.
Let's keep brushing that under the rug.
Right, exactly. So listen, I want to make sure that you know that you are welcome to burst into reading examples of your work at any moment. Talking about the erotic mind is swell and all, but savoring the fruits of that mind's labor is even better.
All right, well, let me just... I should read from something that you can't find anywhere, so we'll make
good.
It special.
Oh, yeah, thank you.
Here we go. I know I've not read this one. Ever, I don't think. I once whacked off in the family van on a trip to Disney World in the summer before my sophomore year in high school. This is not such a startling confession, except for the fact that my family, parents, younger brother, even grandparents, were in the van with me, chugging down the highway. The trip occurred during the pinnacle of my heyday of masturbation. Not long after I had sprouted my first erection, I quickly took to self-gratification as my most beloved pastime. If one was to examine my personal history of organized youth athletics, my sudden disinterest in activities involving balls could easily be correlated with the discovery of my own. Had a trophy existed for such a feat as excessive self-abuse, I would have surely had several lined up next to my more legitimate awards. Certainly I would have earned the coveted most improved all around.
I love it. So what are the reviewers of one of your books, Are You There, God? It's Me, Kevin, a memoir, wrote, in this hilarious confessional memoir, Kevin Keck tries to come to terms with the intense lack of meaning in his life. At 26, Keck felt that he was losing his mind. When anxieties about his ultimate purpose weren't manifesting themselves in struggles with OCD or depression, they swing him into a mania that drives him from one dysfunctional girlfriend to the next, all of whom resemble his mother in their shared capacity for personalized madness. That's a mouthful. Have you had any better luck with the ultimate purpose thing since you wrote Are You There, God?
Well, I have to say that I don't know about the ultimate purpose, but kids go a long way towards solving one's immediate purpose.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah, and, you know, because you don't want to raise uncool people. Because, you know, you've met uncool people, and you've thought, God, what was this idiot's parents like? You know, you think if they just had cooler parents, they would have turned out okay.
Yeah.
So,
and I suspect the mania that drove you from one dysfunctional girlfriend to the next has subsided now a bit, now that you're married. Is that right? he hesitates.
Yes, God, it's a shame that my wife's not in the background now, because she would be chuckling knowingly. No, I found someone as equally as dysfunctional as I, and we have begun solving our various dysfunctions together.
Well, that's cool.
She tells me I'm an asshole, and
yes.
and I nod and go, I'll work on that. magically, both our problems go away.
There's probably a book in there somewhere.
I hope so. I hope I can make a little bit more money off this marriage. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not that mercenary.
So that reviewer I just mentioned goes on to say, in search of sanity, he returns to his childhood home in North Carolina, only to be met with serious doses of reality in the form of his congenitally reclusive brother, manic depressive mother, and grandmother who is suffering from advanced Alzheimer's. His grandfather and dad are there too, but they never leave the basement where they continually repair a single lawnmower. This is great stuff, and I gather that it's pretty smutty too, but not as much as your earlier memoir, Oedipus Wrecked.
I think there is actually at least one scene in the God book that is more smutty.
Is that
than
right?
Anything that I wrote in Oedipus Wrecked, at least from my perspective, because it was just so bizarre. But now, I mean, if you want to have fun, then know that I am speaking to you right now from my childhood home.
Oh, my kid. Really?
My neighbors are, in fact, my parents.
Oh, my goodness.
And the house where my grandfather and dad repaired that lawnmower is actually my house now. My grandparents both passed away a couple of years ago. And and I basically came into that house.
Wow. And you don't have much of a North Carolina accent.
Well, you know, even when I lived here, people told me that. And, you know, I lived up in New York, upstate for a while. And I don't know if that had any effect on my accent. Plus, I don't know, I kind of go out of my way to not have it.
Right.
Curiously enough, people are somewhat judgmental about that, but I will put it on if I feel that it will get me somewhere. If I'm speaking to my local people, mm-hmm. that totally shifts.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I don't have the accent, they will not treat me the same way.
Yeah, they'll think you're an interloper.
Yeah, it's very... It's
one of them damn Yankees.
Man, it is very Faulkner-esque where I live. It is a strange place that's situated at the base of the Appalachian Mountains and sort of north of Charlotte, which is this wonderful banking city.
Mm-hmm.
And what was once, you know, vast farmland was all flooded when they built the dam for the hydroelectric plant, uh-huh. which ultimately becomes the nuclear plant. And, it's all that little stuff coalescing has made for a very weird, weird place.
Hmm. Hmm. Is it more suburban or is it still pretty rural?
Well, it was very rural up until about 5 or 6 years ago. And, you know, in classic sort of, you know, the American tradition, the highway has expanded. I feel like I'm in that Bugs Bunny cartoon, you know, where he sort of goes in his hole and wakes up and there's like a highway that's been built above him, because that's exactly what has happened. You know, there was thousands of acres of woods around me and they've expanded the highway and now I have a super Walmart that I could walk to if I wanted to, you know, whereas previously you couldn't walk anywhere. Oh, but thank God they've got, you can buy alcohol now. I grew up in a dry county.
Mm.
And not until all of the people from up north left the, you know, failing industry up there and moved down here did we have enough people that liked to drink so that we could change the laws. And it's made this place so tolerable. That's why I've moved back, is because I can buy a beer.
Well, there's some redeeming qualities then, absolutely. So one of the reviewers that wrote about Oedipus Wrecked said that Kevin Keck mines a rich vein of candid confessional humor, hilariously recounting every grim detail of his absurd sexual history. Do you really think that you have an absurd sexual history?
Yeah, but the what makes it so absurd is it's mostly me.
Ah.
You know, there's not too many other participants a lot of the time.
Uh-huh.
So much of Oedipus Wrecked is just the failed experiments of one man, you know, but what's really strange is, you know, as those essays sort of appeared on their own before the book came out,
I
would get, you know, lots of, mail from people telling me that they'd had the same experience,
mm-hmm.
Or that, you know, that somehow my own confession of, masturbation gone awry, mm-hmm. Which, that just can't be anything but funny, because it's so simple. How could you do it incorrectly? At least I think as a man, that's that way. I hear women expressing a completely different feeling about that. But
all the stuff that I've read of yours, I mean, as a sex therapist, it's, you know, the kind of things that I've heard from people, you know, over the years. I mean, there wasn't anything outlandishly spectacular. It was as funny as all get out. But I think that was your intention as well.
Well, I would say initially that was my only intention, was to write a funny story, and I just happen to like dick jokes. but I'm not a very good joke writer, uh-huh. As self-contained little units, but I can kind of tell a funny story. That's a relatively Southern thing. I mean, you come around here, everybody can tell a story. Mm-hmm. But I just happen to tell those stories. As it turned out, I began to think more about, the motivations of, eroticism and whatnot. But initially I was just trying to make people laugh.
Mm-hmm. And what better way than with dirty humor? It's a universal, I think.
Oh yeah. No, every culture that you begin to explore, you realize they have a fascination with penises for some reason. And I can't blame them.
So, you were going to be a priest, but you were not a cradle Catholic, I gather. Is that right?
That's right. That just seems, of all the things I've set out to do in my life, that one seems the most illogical from this vantage point. Mm-hmm. But, there was something I liked about there was an appeal about monastic life, because there was the college, yeah, very close to here, has an abbey associated with, mm-hmm, it. And, and especially monks who, their ultimate purpose in being there, their work that, obviously their ultimate purpose is to develop their relationship with God, but to make money, they teach literature, or philosophy or science. Uh-huh. And I thought, oh, what a great deal that would be.
Yeah.
Cause I'm very, interested, in theological matters as much as I am sort of, sexual matter. I mean, it's really that dichotomy of the sacred and the profane, mm-hmm, both attract me. Mm-hmm. And to me, all that is sacred. I hate to frame it, sacred, profane, like,
right,
something about sexuality and the body's dirty. It's, yeah, not. To me, it's all a way of finding a sort of transcendence of the self. Some of the most transcendent moments I've ever had in my life have come when I've, been making love with someone I deeply care about.
Yes.
As some type of deeply meditative religious experience, mm-hmm, or smoking weed.
Not necessarily in that order.
No, if we're just going to get down to brass tacks, there have been some times smoking weed when I've really had transcendent moments. But, in a way that's kind of cheating. well, maybe not. I don't know.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the path to, this enlightenment or this religious ecstasy or even physical ecstasy, the path that takes us there, it's a good thing, it seems to me. And sometimes that involves substances, for good or for worse. And, we ought to be honest about that kind of stuff. But your point about the dichotomy between the sacred and the profane, or the flesh and the spirit, or all those kind of things, are of great interest to me, because I was a Catholic priest for 20 years. It was not a particularly happy relationship, I might add. I was never orthodox in any way, shape, or form. I was always, you know, kind of rebellious and stuff like that. And then went off and did my doctorate in clinical sexology. In fact, I'm the only Catholic priest in the world with a doctorate in clinical sexology. And that was my undoing. And because I wrote my thesis about the sexual attitudes and behaviors of gay Catholic priests in the active ministry back in 1981. Before there was such a thing as gay priests, and so I
how
was
long before they
priest.
Excommunicated you?
Actually, I never was excommunicated. I was drummed out of my religious community. But I, you know, technically, I'm still a priest. I don't function in such a manner because I'm not a believer. I'm a priest, but not a believer. But it's an interesting kind of thing because I continually go back to this topic, and oftentimes with authors like yourself in this series about this connection between the divine and the human and spirituality and sexuality and stuff like that. I think it's a fascinating thing.
Well, you know, those... you know, those experiences that I described in the various circumstances, they've all carried with me a certain similarity in how they felt, mm-hmm. you know, and the sort of feeling I had coming away from that. And yeah, I just don't, I mean, I guess I can see how some people would not view things in that way.
Yes.
But I think often those are people who have not experienced those very positive aspects.
Yeah. I just never could understand why, you know, people wanted to separate the two. And, you know, I mean, love and passion and all of that kind of stuff is a wonderful, good thing. You know, I mean, if you are a theist, you know, then it's the creation of, you know, the divine in our life. And it's a reflection of, you know, a lot of, you know, sacred writers, you know, talk about that kind of thing. Those are those connections between, you know, humanity and the divinity. And so I don't know, it just seems like, why would we denigrate something that is such a powerful thing? Maybe it's because it's powerful.
I don't know, do you ever, I mean, you know, my feeling on that is I always feel like Eastern religions maybe had a more healthy handle on that aspect of it. There's something about, you know, all of these, the history of thought that comes out of Western civilization that has to split things into that powerful dichotomy.
Right.
You know, there's that inability to hold opposing thoughts in one's head. Mm-hmm. And realize that both can exist at the same time. You know, it doesn't have to be an either or,
right.
You know,
right.
fallacy. So,
right. How did you get your start as a writer? Did you write as a kid?
I did.
Universal in all of this, my conversations with all the authors and even the artists. You know, they all started as kids in their chosen effort.
Yeah, well, you know, I think initially you have this desire to entertain yourself, mm-hmm. you know, and, you know, cause I remember the stories I wrote were only for my own consumption.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I sort of didn't participate in a lot of things as a teenager so I could stay home and write, which, some of that, I think, was just anxiety that has dogged me throughout my existence, and that sort of made me uncomfortable going out in social situations, but there was an upshot in that I would sit at home and write very long poems.
Hmm.
And I have to say I'm a little bit impressed with myself for being able to do that now, because I was that all that work that I put in, I think, has, you know, I feel like it's given me a slight edge in some ways, although at the same time, I'm as equally undisciplined now as I was disciplined then in terms of my approach to work. But I got more shit going on now, man. it's just hard to find time anyway.
When did you discover the power of adding erotic or sexual material to your work? Or was it in there all along?
Well, I think I discovered it as a component of comedy pretty early.
You mentioned that earlier, too, yeah.
Yeah, it was just, I realized that that was a way to make people laugh, and I seemed to be able to do that when none of the other people in my immediate social circle would do that or were uncomfortable because, you know, once again, this is a really repressive area to grow up in terms of being comfortable with sexuality or anything regarding the body,
mm-hmm.
At least in a public manner. As I've gotten older, I've realized that many of the people who I thought were, you know, completely chaste in the in their behavior were in fact not, and were doing all of the exciting and fun stuff that I talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I just sort of figured out that that would make people laugh, and then I think I started encountering writers who brought that into their work, and that was a real revelation when I started coming across people who spoke directly to that. You know, at first it was sort of, you know, the somewhat tepid stuff you get in reading various Jack Kerouac novels,
right.
You know. But then you start reading Charles Bukowski and Henry Miller, and it just takes it to a, you know, completely new understanding of what you are able to speak about as an artist,
right.
You know. Because if you just read F. Scott Fitzgerald and Ernest Hemingway, you think, oh, I have to either go to Princeton or go to Africa,
uh-huh.
You know, and hunt lions. Those are my options.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, I think who else was it? I think Bukowski was talking about he had the same feeling when he picked up that John Fante novel, Ask the Dust,
mm-hmm.
where he, you know, he's like, here's a guy who's writing about being on Skid Row and having to scramble to pay the rent, and I know what that's like, and it, you know, he felt like it gave him the license to give his own voice to that. And I sort of felt the same way, you know, first through comedy, because I always have been a student of comedy. Because I think that's way harder than tragedy. If you can go up to anybody on the street and say, tell me a sad story, and somebody will hit you with a sad story,
mm-hmm.
I think 100% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Sad stories are a dime a dozen.
Right.
You know, we've all lost a pet. We've all lost somebody close to us. You know, it's we all know that material. But what's funny is interesting to me because it varies so much from person to person. It's so much more subjective, I think, than tragedy, you know, it just that so it becomes an interesting, you know, animal for me to study. But of course, comedy is one of those things that when you start talking about it and picking it apart, it no longer is funny.
Right. Well, that's a great segue. Would you mind reading a bit more of your work for us?
Sure. I will read something from Ass Backwards.
Okay.
And, here we go. When I was 16, my mom confessed to me that she had a vibrator, which a friend had given to her, but which she never used. She just liked to keep it around for laughs. Within a day, I found the vibrator and immediately plunged it into my own ass while in a fit of vigorous masturbation. I could spend the rest of my life in analysis and never get to the bottom of that one. In fact, I don't even know why I felt the need to stimulate my prostate. I wasn't even aware I had one, unless on some level my ass knew that such an act of appropriating your mother's sex toy is the modern equivalent of killing your father. My best guess, though, is that I had read something in Hustler. How was I to know that when I went to the doctor's for a routine exam, his nurse would give me a physical I would never forget, or so it goes. Or perhaps I just wanted to see what was up with all those, quote, fags. Eventually, though, the vibrator vanished. I don't know if my mom pressed her ear to the bathroom door one night only to hear a familiar whir, or if my constant treatments of bleach, hey, sanitation first, to the vibe surface, irritated her in some fashion that she couldn't fathom and she tossed it. Either way, such a loss led me to desperate measures involving cucumbers, a broom handle, a fire poker, just the handle, and in an incident I refer to simply as the Chiquita affair, a banana that broke off inside me. I nearly killed myself straining to get that out as quickly as possible, and let me tell you, there's nothing more fucked up than shitting a banana.
I love it. How is it that you're so comfortable in your own skin that you're able to describe your sexual exploits like that in such detail? Or are these sexual explicit revelations a means of exorcising your demons?
Well, I don't know how I might have answered that a couple days ago, but now I'm beginning to think if I wasn't aware I was an asshole for all these years, that I just didn't have the good sense to be at all embarrassed by that. No, I don't know. I was thinking about this actually yesterday as I was mowing the grass, of all things, the writer George Saunders, who he teaches at Syracuse, and he came in teaching there as after I had already started in grad school, and he has the book Civil War Land and Bad Decline, which is a very fine book. I highly recommend it. But he's such a nice guy, and he's such a great writer, and he is also very open personally, mm-hmm. not in his writing, but personally. He's such an open person that I was thinking that, you know, I've met many writers who have this quality, that they are personable in such a way as to disarm you so that you will open up to them. And I think that writers perhaps have a different way of treating information they consider to be personal. Like, there is stuff in my life that I will just never talk about or tell anybody, you know? But what that stuff is would probably seem very innocuous compared to stuff I've written about.
It's so true.
But yeah, I think that's perhaps a, you know, and I don't know if it's a sort of strange artistic evolution, and that you learn how to get people to open up so that you can then mine them for material. I don't know. I've wondered about that because I did have an experience a couple of years ago where I was giving a reading from Oedipus Rex, and it was in Charlotte. And I had initially not been able to get a reading from this book. In fact, I got very few readings on this book because the material was so... Can you hear my kids in the background,
yes.
By the way?
Uh-huh.
Those are the twins. The material was so... I think some people felt for it to be read aloud in a bookstore where there might be children in there. And I totally get that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I totally understand why people wouldn't want that read, because I'm going to have a difficult enough time explaining to my own children when they're older, you know, why I wrote this. And not because of the material, but more like, why did I write this to make their lives so difficult and make them hang their heads in shame around the schoolyard? I had a tough time getting readings for this, and I finally had gotten one, and a lot of people I knew were there, and in fact, a lot of students of mine are there because I still teach, you know, someone requested that I read from I Was a Teenage Homosexual, and it had been a long time since I had looked at that story, and I was a little bit surprised at how open I was
mm-hmm.
in that story. I don't sorry the kid I'm
that's
sorry.
All right, fine.
I wrote a lot of these stories at a very interesting time in my life, a time that is in fact covered in Are You There, God? But I never make reference to the fact that I'm writing this other stuff at the time, in part because writers writing about writers is, I think, a little bit of a tightrope to navigate. But, mm-hmm. You know, I was basically living on a friend's couch, and I had just sort of abdicated all responsibility in my life at that point, except for maintaining auto insurance and showing up to teach, you know, my classes at the community college a couple days a week. And so I don't know. I think I was experiencing a certain personal freedom that allowed me to be free in my work.
Interesting. Listen, I'm afraid that our time has expired for today. I have so much more that I want to ask you. Is it possible for you to come back next week?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, yay. Excellent. And you'll read more for us, I hope.
Yes, of course.
Okay. But before we go, Kevin, could you give us your website address and walk us around a bit and let us know what we can find there?
Yeah, it's www.thekeck, T-H-E-K-E-C-K, all one word, .com, thekeck.com. And I have a somewhat minimalist website by design. You go there, there's links to a lot of the stories that appear in Oedipus Rex that originally appeared on nerve.com. And there's more recent work I've done, which not as graphic, but I think equally as funny in places, talking about having kids. And, you know, links to other interviews, and of course, links to where you can buy books.
Yay! That's the most important thing. Well, until next week, then, we will be visiting you in cyberspace.
All right. Thanks,
Richard. Thanks, Kevin. Hey, what a fabulous show, huh? Well, tune in next week for more of my interview with Kevin Keck and more Sex Advice with an Edge with your host, me, Dr. Dick. Again, this week's podcast sponsor is Dr. Dick's How-To Video Library. Listen up, buckaroos. Thanks to this amazing technology, you'll be able to watch your choice of smut from the comfort of your own home. With just a little prompting from you, they're going to come gushing out of your computer like nobody's business. Check it out. You'll find a link to this fabulous sex resource right there on the front page of drdicksexadvice.com. Look for the tab that reads Video on Demand. There is no membership fee. This is a pay-per-minute kind of deal. Remember that what you pay for in viewing minutes allows you to watch whatever content you want for whatever length of time you choose. Pretty gall darn sweet, huh?
We've done the Battle of the Wills. The deck stacked in my favor. You're just going to lose again.
I didn't know this was a competition. I'm going to have to try harder. Listen, sex fans, I hope you're also following my other series of interviews called Sex Edge-ucation. In these podcasts, I converse with prominent practitioners, educators, and advocates of unconventional sexual expressions and lifestyles. We investigate the world of fetish sex and kink, and we discuss topics like BDSM, power play, polyamory, and swinging. This series appears on Wednesdays. My regular podcasts, like this one, continue on Mondays. And look for all of Dr. Dick's podcasts on iTunes. You'll find me in the podcast section under Health, subcategory Sexuality, or just search for Dr. Dick's Sex Advice. Don't forget to subscribe and leave a comment when you do.
I'll die before I go anywhere with you.
Okay, let's have it your way. Until next week, remember, sex is good, and good sex? Why, that's even better. Over and out.